In our reading today, we just have a little tiny bit of that bit of the Bible passage, so perhaps it would be worthwhile to recollect more of what happens. Jesus is crucified on a Friday, what is called Good Friday, the beginning of the Sabbath for the Jewish people. So they take him down from the cross before the Sabbath begins, but they are not allowed to do any kind of work or anything like that on the Sabbath. So he's hastily placed in a tomb that is nearby, but all of the proper rites and rituals, they're not able to carry out. Now, it isn't as if the disciples at this point are very focused or well organized about what they should be doing, because the arrest of Jesus, his unwillingness to defend himself, Pontius Pilate's helpless need, therefore, to convict him and to turn him over to be crucified, the mob which has been incited by the priests, who are the ones who are against Jesus, to declaim against him, Jesus allowing himself to be taken and to be placed on the cross, and then actually dying, is not at all what any of the disciples have expected. Many times in the ministry of Jesus, he has been confronted by powerful forces that had the authority to be able to arrest him, or even to put him to death, or to stone him to death. And many times through the storytelling of the Bible, Jesus pushes those who are against him right to the edge, but then in some way slips away. So his disciples, over the course of time, have come to believe in him more and more deeply. And Jesus has been testing them and training them and giving them opportunities to prove their inner determination to follow him and to accept that he is in fact the chosen of God and the Messiah and the Christ. And all of the prophecies that have spoken of the Messiah, which are many, and all of his disciples are familiar with them, and Jesus himself refers to them, all speak of the triumph of the Messiah. And the Jewish people, to whom he was the messenger from God, definitely need a hero at this point. They are oppressed by the Romans. They are oppressed by their own corrupt priesthood. And all of the former glory is just a wishful hope. There are small bands of the Essene communities in which the pure light of true Judaism is kept alive, but their external life is fragmented. So the coming of Jesus into the situation and the increasing belief on the part of the disciples that he is really their Messiah, naturally their minds run into how they expect that to play out. It's the same with all of us. When things begin to go our way, we automatically jump many steps ahead about how that's going to play out. We have all these expectations. This will happen, that will happen. We set our lives in a certain way. And of course, in such a moment, in the company of such spiritual greatness, that's what the disciples expected. Instead, one of the 12 apostles, Judas, actually betrays him. One of their own acts against the Lord himself. Jesus is seized, he's tortured, he's humiliated, and so on, convicted and crucified and dies. At the time that Jesus is on the cross, most of the disciples are no longer present. Mary Magdalene is there, his mother Mary is there, St. John is there, but most of the other disciples were so agitated, confused, and frightened, because what had happened to Jesus could now easily happen to them, because he was part, they are all part of the band, they're all declared outlaws. So then he actually dies on the cross. And no one talks to you in the Bible about what that Sabbath was like, what that time was like when they were just simply having to live with the reality of the fact that he was in fact gone, and all of their hopes had been shattered. Now Mary Magdalene, having the courage to be at the foot of the cross and having other qualities about her, being female and being utterly motivated by just her heart's love, in this case, her feminine consciousness was a benefit to her because she wasn't thinking so much about conditions and circumstances. She had this one-pointed devotion. So as soon as she was able, according to the Jewish law, to act at the end of the Sabbath, Mary Magdalene cometh early while it is not yet even light. This is the first moment she has. And her intention as she's coming is at least now we can treat the body of our Lord in the right way. And as she's coming to the tomb, in a practical sense, she's thinking, they've put him in this cave and they've rolled this huge rock in front of the opening. And she's by herself and she's carrying the things that she plans to use to dress the body. How am I going to get the rock open? You know, it's a very human story. But when she gets there, she sees that the rock has been rolled away. Now, this is not in itself uplifting to her, because she immediately assumes that the enemies of Jesus have not only killed him, but they're going to dishonor his body. So she rushes in to look inside, and she sees that the body is gone, and all that's left are the winding sheets just piled up there. And her only thought is they've stolen the body. It doesn't immediately occur to her the rest of the Easter story. So she runs back as fast as she can, and she gets two of the men, Peter and John. And now just picture it. You know, she must be nearly hysterical by this point, absolutely worn out with grief, what to speak of running to the tomb and back again. She runs to Peter and John and says, they've taken him away. So the two of them come racing out, you know, sort of to see what's happening. And they look in also. See, only the winding sheets and no one really knows. And then they go away, a little bewildered by this. And Mary looks in, Mary Magdalene looks in again. There's two angels there. And they say, you know, what are you looking for? And Mary says, they've taken away the Lord. And the angels answer, why are you looking for the living among the dead? You know? And that's the beginnings of the reversal of this whole story from tragedy and disappointment and suffering and dismay into what it is really about, which is transcendence and victory and courage and facing and overcoming. And so she comes out again and she sees what she perceives to be the gardener. This is sort of like little cosmic jokes that are put in here. She turns around and she sees a figure dressed in white over to the side, and she thinks he's the gardener. So maybe he knows something, maybe he saw something. She rushes up to him, all without thought. You know, she's not concerned about anything. They've taken away the Lord. Have you seen him? And this figure stands up and says, Mary? And when she hears her voice spoken, she realizes that this man standing in front of her is Jesus himself. Now, live through that just for a moment. Can you, I mean, all of us have had times in our lives when we've been grief-stricken, disappointed, overcome with tears and sorrow, who knows? And then often gradually, or perhaps if we're fortunate, suddenly those clouds lift. But can you imagine anything of the magnitude of what happened to her? It's like all sorrows and all triumph is just condensed into that one word, Mary. Just like that, the Lord calls her name. And she, in her enthusiasm, wants to throw herself at his feet and grab his feet. And here a little bit of the esoteric comes in. Says, don't touch me yet. She speaks to him. She recognizes him. Rabbi, she says, master, master, she says. She wants to throw herself at his feet. And he says, you can't touch me yet. I am not yet fully ascended. I can't explain it to you, truthfully, except that Jesus said it would take 3 days for him to raise the temple. So he can appear to her, but she can't yet embrace him. So now Mary has gone from complete despair to a state of absolute ecstasy. So she runs back to tell the disciples again. She tells them, the body is gone, but it makes no difference because the Lord himself is risen as he promised. He stood before me. The disciples say, yeah. And really, it's easy to fault them, but here's this one woman claiming, who's almost mad with grief, And suddenly she's probably hysterical with joy because the gardener turned out to be Jesus and the angels were in the tomb and they told her, certainly, certainly. But who knows? Because the Bible doesn't tell us. You know, who believed her, who didn't believe her, who dared to hope, who was afraid to hope. Isn't it all the human emotions that would act out in that time? You know, this desire to want to believe, but this unwillingness to be taken advantage of, not having been hurt enough and now wanting to protect ourselves, not wanting to go forward and be made a fool of. Is it a trick of the priests? All these different things. What do they think about Mary Magdalene? Do they really trust her? All of this plays out. But Master tells us something extremely important in this story here. Because the next day, it says, the disciples were gathered together in a locked room. But Master points out that they came back together. Because what held them together was their devotion to Jesus. And if any one of them had lost their devotion to Jesus, they would not be coming back together. Because that bond would have been broken. You know, they may have become friends and so on, but the reason they looked to each other is because now in this world gone mad in which all of their expectations had been shattered, their place of refuge was their community. You know, whatever had happened now, they had shared something. And the power of that, of course, had not just been between each one with Jesus, but also had been the power of one another. It's very interesting that Jesus' mission was a great deal about community, just as Paramahansa Yogananda's is. And in their hour of need, they found solace in one another. There's a profound divine teaching here. Here we are, in fact, gathered together as a divine community to hear this story. Each one of us could be reading the Bible at home if we wanted to. But we instinctively know that coming together with like-minded souls and sharing in that vibration together gives us a power that we don't have on our own. So out of their faith, in spite of everything, they were gathered together, but they were frightened because Jesus had been arrested. Judas had betrayed Jesus. How many of the rest of them had he betrayed? You know, who knew where they were at any moment, what was going to happen? And they had the door locked. That's how they describe it. Locked together in fear of all the authorities. And it had been few among us could contemplate what they had seen done to Jesus with calmness, with courage, without fear. So there they are, and now Jesus, and the way the Bible describes it, which is as all metaphysical stories of resurrected masters describe it, the master does not use physical agency to come in. He's not there, and then he's there. Because it doesn't happen in the realm of time and space where things take a while. He just isn't there, and then he's there. There he stood in the midst of them. Now, again, imagine. These disciples did not stand at the cross. Only Peter and John had seen the empty tomb. Mary Magdalene is the only one who knows. And then just suddenly, all of their fear and anxiety and confusion, there he's standing in the midst of them. And what does he say? Peace, peace, peace. I mean, he says it, it's always put out like, peace be unto you, which of course is one of the things he often said, but I'm sure he was also saying, peace, peace, be calm, don't worry, look, I'm back, I'm here. Now, none of these souls, I mean, all of the apostles were great souls, and you don't really know what kind of inner divine awareness they have. You don't know sort of where their consciousness could go in their meditation practice. Yogananda said that Jesus taught his disciples Kriya Yoga or something very much like it, is how he put it. Meaning that Jesus' teaching taught individuals how to go inside and to experience the presence of God. He didn't just speak to them, he taught them how to do it. He would have had to have taught them, and it would have had to have been similar to Kriya Yoga, which is what is taught here, because Kriya simply means the action which takes you into the state of God realization. And it's not owned by any guru or any religion or any teaching or any master. It's any incarnated being in a human body who wishes to experience the full potential of our consciousness goes into the inner spine, raises the kundalini energy through the chakras, and experiences the divine light at the single eye of spirit that Jesus spoke of. Now, when Yogananda writes in Autobiography of a Yogi, which is referred to in our reading today, he writes about 1936, not 2,000 years ago, 1936, in India, he goes back from America where Yogananda lived. He's called back by his guru, Sri Yukteswar, and this is the last year of Sri Yukteswar's life. And during the time that Yogananda is visiting in India, Sri Yukteswar leaves his body. He's in his 80s. He leaves it in the lotus posture by his own choice. There's no dramatic story. But from the point of view of the disciple, Yogananda, his guru is gone. And Yogananda plays the story out a little bit for the sake of the book. But nonetheless, he feels deeply bereft because his guru is gone. And then he talks to us about his guru materializing in front of him to ease his grief. And Yogananda is very exact in that book, in a way that the Bible isn't, to explain to us that this was not a vision. This was Sri Yukteswar simply by the power of his spiritual understanding. You see, all of us live in these physical bodies because our soul consciousness creates a magnetic force that draws together material atoms and makes this physical body. That's what the little baby does in the womb. The sperm and the ovum come together. There's a flash of light in the astral world. A soul that's in tune with that light enters into that first joining of the cells. And then by the divine power within that consciousness, it draws together the atoms from creation through its magnetism and makes its little body. And in its little body is all the potential of these great big bodies that we now have. And it takes time, and the soul does that with unconscious force, but a master simply can do it with conscious force and draw those atoms together again. So Sri Yukteswar materializes by creating that magnetic force, and there's the body. And Yogananda wants us to understand that this is a miracle from our point of view, but he also has a whole chapter in his book called The Law of Miracles, in which he explains how these are simply subtle scientific laws. And he describes to us how this body is a real physical body. It's not just a sort of shadowy thing of light or vision. And Yogananda is very explicit. He kneels at the feet of Sri Yukteswar and feels the bump of his toes through his familiar canvas shoes. He's even wearing clothes, which were the clothes that he wore when he was alive. And then he talks about how he holds him in this tight grip, and even the fragrance of his physical body was the same. Because Sri Yukteswar is wanting to demonstrate, and rarely are these events demonstrated for the public at large, but for special dispensation, we are at least told about them. Autobiography of a Yogi is such a dispensation, partly because Yogananda's mission in this world was to tell us not to diminish in any way the greatness of Jesus, but to put the teachings of Jesus in their true context. That this is a reality, not that just happened once and we have no idea how it happened or whether it will ever happen again, but a truth that is simply there. That even though we feel so often at times just overcome by the forces of this world, you know, by the aspirations that are not fulfilled, by the moments of happiness that are followed by some kind of disappointment, by the inevitable end of life, whether it comes to a young child or to an old man, that sooner or later everything we're doing just rolls out and seems to just fall through our fingers. And sometimes it ends with great suffering. But the masters come to tell us. Jesus comes to say, the first thing he says is, be at peace. All of this agitation in this world, and what could be worse than what those disciples have gone through, it means nothing. In another place, Jesus says, the world will persecute you as it persecuted me. But be of good cheer, Jesus says, for I have conquered the world. I often just love that, the sort of Who knows how he delivered it? I always imagine him delivering it with a slight chuckle. Just be of good cheer, you know, because what difference does it make? The power of Christ transcends everything. So here, in the most irrefutable, dramatic way, he's standing in front of him. And he's manifesting, as Yogananda describes Sri Yukteswar, his actual body. He's not shimmering, he's just standing there. And in fact, Jesus reappears over the next 40 days, and some of the resurrections, the times when he comes again, are really quite charming. He's on the beach, and they're fishing, and he calls them back to the shore. There's a story, they're out fishing, and they're not having any luck all night, and they're about to come back in, and a man from the shore says, "Why don't you throw the net one more time on the right side?" Jesus playing with his disciples. So they throw the net one more time on the right side, and it's just so full of fish they can hardly even get it in. And then in that moment, Peter realizes that this figure on the beach is Jesus. They describe how he jumps out of the boat and swims the 100 or so yards, leaves the boat, leaves everything. Jesus has a little fire going, and he's frying fish. And he says, "Bring some fish." And they bring the fish over, and they all fry fish together, and they share bread, and Jesus eats. You know, he's trying to get them to understand. It's a strange sort of thing. I'll tell you a story related to this. I met a yogi in the Himalayas above Badrinath, about 12,000 feet. He's a very interesting character. I don't really know that much about him, except that he's at 12,000 feet in the Himalayas, and the snow falls, you know, like 10 or 12 feet, and absolutely buries everything, buries all the little cabins and kutirs. The temple at Badrinath closes. They take the image down to about 7,000 feet and do all the worship for the winter until Badrinath opens again. And all the yogis come out of the mountains and go live lower, except for this yogi and a couple of others, who stay in their kutirs, are buried under the snow for months, and then when the snow melts, they come out again. They go into a state of suspended animation in cosmic consciousness. Now, this yogi tells us that he's known as Boxwala Baba. Boxwala means the man of the box, because he has this steel box that he sits in to protect his body from being eaten by the tigers. And he just sits in that box, and then he says, then he goes. He leaves his body there, and he goes and spends that time with Babaji in Tibet. So he's just telling me all of this, and I wasn't the only one. There was a small group of us there. So later on, I was talking to Swami Kriyananda about it. And he's asked me what I thought. I said, "Well, I just don't know. I don't know what to think. I never talked to anybody who said things like this." And the whole situation was very inspiring, being up in the mountains in this little kutir and looking out at the high peaks and being at such an altitude, many things about it. And I said, it's sort of like he spoke about it in such a matter-of-fact way. And so then I leave my body and I spend the winter with Babaji in Tibet. And I was presenting that as a point of doubt in my mind. Swami's answer was perfect. He said, "Well, at a certain stage of development, it is matter-of-fact to you." Oh, I never thought about that. You know, that at a certain point, to just leave your body and go off to Tibet, to re-manifest your body, it looks to us like something that we have to ooh and ah about. But really, it's just the most natural thing in the world. And this is what Jesus was trying to communicate to his disciples. "Here I am. I'm really with you. Let's have dinner. Oh, this fish is very good. Would you like some more bread?" You know, we want to, in a real sense, we want to protect ourselves from the responsibility of actually achieving that consciousness ourselves by making sure that it seems really distant from us. You see how the mind sort of wants to not really know? Swami Kriyananda tells us this story when he was a disciple living with Yogananda. And because he had a beard in the 1940s and early 50s, which was unusual. Swami says that's the reason, but I think it was also because he had a very uplifted spiritual demeanor. There was a Masonic lodge that wanted to do a tableau about Jesus in Los Angeles, so they asked Kriyananda if he would come and play the part of Jesus. It was just a pantomime, so all he had to do, as he said, was sit, and every so often he had to sigh like this. And after it was over, Master said to him, "How did it go?" And Swamiji said, oh, it went fine. And then just to be a little, you know, lighthearted, he said, well, he said, I'd much rather be like Jesus than merely look like him. And he said, Master's answer completely startled him, because Master didn't take that as a humorous remark at all. He just said very casually, oh, yes, that will come, that will come. Just like that. This is really who we are. And there's this interplay that we have to act out. And this is what the masters teach us. Paramhansa Yogananda was a fully realized master. And yet when you read autobiography of a yogi, you read about, you know, long nights of weeping, calling to Divine Mother, his prayer to Master Mahashaya, intercede with me with the Divine Mother, and all of this drama, where is my guru? Please, my master, come to me. And then his years with Sri Yukteswar. And you get the impression that he's just like a devotee like any of us, but he's very passionate about his spiritual search. Well, this is no accident, because what the masters want to demonstrate for us is how do we live perfectly in this world? That's what they're trying to get us to understand, is that this is the pathway not only that these great ones have walked, but this is the path that I could walk. A great disservice was done to all of us when some 500 years after Jesus passed away, a council got together and took out of the Bible the missing years of Jesus, which Yogananda declares and many others declare, described his wanderings back to India and to Tibet to return the visit of the three wise men from the East, is how Yogananda describes it. Jesus went and did his sadhana. He found his masters. He went through, for the sake of us, the necessary steps to come to that state of Christ consciousness, just as Yogananda acts out for us, not for their sake, but for ours, so that we can see this is something that we do. This is not something that we just wish would happen or hope doesn't happen, like St. Augustine prayed. St. Augustine prayed to God, make me a saint, but not yet. Torn as he was between his pleasures in the world and his spiritual aspiration, simultaneously his mother was praying, make him a saint now. Whenever a mother comes to me with distress over her child, I said, never underestimate the prayers of a mother. You know, in fact, St. Augustine credits his mother, who was declared a saint in her own right, with making him a saint, because she wouldn't give up. Even when he was not interested, she wouldn't give up. But in any case, we have this dual reality that we have to play because of the true metaphysics of it, which is, it's not that we can lift ourselves by our own efforts. We have to also be lifted up by the grace of God. But in order to be lifted up by the grace of God, which comes to us through the avatar, which comes to us through the guru, so that there is truth in this statement that salvation comes through Jesus Christ for his disciples, yes. Salvation comes through Buddha for the disciples of Buddha, for Yogananda for the disciples of Yogananda. But it is true that the master lifts us up. So in our, but what allows that grace to come into us is our capacity to receive it. And this is what St. John says, to all who received him, speaking of Jesus, to them gave he the power. Jesus gave them the power to become as he was, a living Christ. And that's of the, when we do our Festival of Light every week, Swami Kriyananda picked certain phrases out of the Bible and the Bhagavad Gita, and one of those which we say every week, to all those who receive it. Now, how do we receive it? That word is interesting because we have a word for a modern appliance, which is called a radio receiver. Even as you hear me, I wear a radio receiver, and the signal is transferred through this so that you can hear it through the speaker. There's no wires here. There's a receiver. This is passive. It's set to the right channel, and by the grace of God, usually it works. And it doesn't scream, and you can hear it, you know, just like that. But some action is taken to set this receiver. Well, our hearts, our being, we are receivers of vibrations. We are receivers of vibrations of consciousness. And just as the machine has to be calibrated just exactly, and if it's not calibrated, those signals won't come through. A radio could be sitting here, we wouldn't hear anything. If it's calibrated properly, we could hear any number of things we have no desire to hear, but they're all out there for us to receive. So it is that the love of God, that the uplifting power of the Guru, that the transforming energy of the living Christ is there. And the only limitation is our ability to receive it. And whenever we attune ourselves and do receive it, there's no limit to our gratitude. So we become like Mary Magdalene at the sight of the Lord, thinks only of throwing herself at his feet, as she was when she came into the banquet and anointed his feet and his hair with costly ointment, total disregard of what anyone thought of her, because there's nothing to compare. When we are uplifted in that grace, everything becomes unimportant compared to that. And our sense of gratitude, again, becomes infinite. So we elevate these great ones because we experience their greatness. But we cannot allow that elevating of their greatness to actually create a separation in our hearts. You see? So that when Swamiji says, I'd rather be like Christ, Master says, that will come, that will come. And it's not a spiritual attitude to say, oh Lord, not me. No, you have to say, yes, I suppose it will, won't it? You know? And if not today, maybe an hour from now. Why not? Yogananda assured his disciples, he said to one of his disciples, you must understand, God does not love me more than he loves you. God doesn't love Krishna or Buddha more than he loves you. He is our common father. God loves all of us equally. And if it seems to be different, the favors of God, it's not because of discrimination on the part of the infinite. It is entirely our ability to receive. And this is why over and over again, we live through these stories about Jesus. Because when you think of Mary Magdalene running to the tomb and running to get to the disciples and seeing Jesus and falling at his feet, she's acting on our behalf. And in the extraordinary glory of that story, we can find our attunement with these living Christs and then be one of those who receives him. God bless you.